Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Ratcatcher, and we need to talk about Kevin director Lynn Ramsey on her new psychosexual drama, Die My Love, starring Robert Pattinson and Jennifer Lawrence. Misan Herriman is one of the world's most famous photographers, and he talks to me about being the subject of a new film, Shoot the People, which is on at this year's Cork International Film Festival. Plus, we're back with Predator, this time in the Badlands. You can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all. I do hope you are doing well. And thank you to all the people who got in touch last week, not about movies, but about running marathons. Lots of you did it and lots of you have done marathons in the past and you shared some stories. Don't worry, I'm not going to talk about the marathon again this week. The fact that I did it in less than 4 hours. I won't bore you with that again, but thank you to everyone who got in touch. Now, on TV, it was funny. I was driving my nephew to the train last week. My nephew-in-law, not that that really matters. He's a nephew by marriage. He's still my nephew. Like Gene Hackman and Royal Tannenbaum's always introduced Gwyneth Paltrow as his adopted daughter. He's my nephew, one way or the other. And we were talking about TV and film, as is often the case when I'm in cars with people. And I was telling him, he was starting to get into The Sopranos, and he was telling me how he was really enjoying it. And I said to him, it's the greatest TV show of all time. And he looked at me, he said, I don't know about that. So what do you do when a 19-year-old questions your vast TV and cinematic knowledge? Threw him out of the car is what I did. No, I didn't. He got his train. But there you go. Now, in TV this week, I was watching this.
You thinking what I'm thinking?
Well, if you're thinking, what is my husband doing sat on his ass listening to local news reports while he could be out collecting debts for jobs he hasn't been paid for, then yeah, I am, which is spooky.
Actually, what I was thinking was this house explosion could be a bit of a cash cow.
In what way, exactly?
Well, due diligence. Maybe the gas company didn't do it.
Maybe this case could go all the way to the top.
Well, maybe sort of all the way to the middle. The bottom of the middle. Middle of the bottom.
Joe.
No? Anyway, I might do a bit of sniffing around.
Oh, God, when did you last sniff around these? Spring?
Ah, yes, the great Emma Thompson there, opposite her husband in this show, Joe, played by Adam Godley. This is from Down Cemetery Road, a new series on Apple TV, dropping weekly. There are three parts there. And what will interest you at the outset, if you're a Slow Horses fan, is that this is based on the man who wrote that, Mick Herron's first novel, Down Cemetery Road. It takes place in Oxford, and you heard Emma Thompson there kind of arguing with her husband. She's in a marriage of, I wouldn't say convenience, it's of inconvenience, but they run a detective agency together and it's a bit of a raggle-taggle detective agency, but she seems to be quite good at it as the show emerges, because in tandem with that, we have an art restorer played by the great Ruth Wilson, who is at a dinner party one night and there's a massive explosion near her house. What's assumed to be a gas leak in a house has killed some people and a girl has gone missing, presumed dead, but then it turns out she was actually taken. And this gas leak isn't really a gas leak, but something to do with British intelligence. And a whole story, in a kind of Slow Horses way, gets going, where Ruth Wilson's character, Sarah Tucker, and Emma Thompson start to investigate this case together and in tandem, and it rattles along. I've seen 5 episodes of it. Very good. If you like Slow Horses, you'll like this. Probably a little funnier and maybe not as serious, but it's pretty serious as well. Now, some people aren't loving it and claiming it doesn't all hang together. There's too many parts going on because there's a lot of storylines. You have this British intelligence story. You have Ruth Wilson, who's also kind of having some problems with her own husband. You have Emma Thompson and her husband, Joe, and there's a lot going on. There's a whole other group of intelligence officers, some of whom may be going rogue, and it kind of turns into a road movie or a road TV series when they go on the road, these various characters, in pursuit of this missing girl. So there's a lot going on, but it's very entertaining, really twisty, some great twists in it. Emma Thompson, she can just do no wrong. She was on this show 4 weeks ago. Regular listeners will know I made her cry. I'm not bragging about that. She got upset about remembering some of her movies. A delightful interview. But she's just such a wonderful actress. She really is. You don't need me to tell you that. So Down Cemetery Road, if there's a slow horses gap in your life, which there could well be, I think this will do the business for you. It's 8 parts. It's on Apple TV. Very well acted, very well written, very entertaining. So that's Down Cemetery Road on Apple TV. Do let me know what you might have been watching. You can email screentime@newstalk.com. The big new cinema release of the week is the latest, and I believe it might be the 9th of its various iterations, of Predator. There is a new Predator movie called Predator Badlands, and it's somewhat set in space. Delighted to be joined now by Ken Doran, who has seen Predator Badlands and joins me now. Ken, this, you know, people might think, does the world need another Predator movie? Where do you stand on this?
Oh, that's a good question, because I was really looking forward to this one. This is from director Dan Trachtenberg, who people might remember did the last installment in the Predator franchise, which was Prey. And I have to say, I watched that in the run-up to this, and maybe it's controversial or sacrilegious even, but I think Prey might be the best Predator movie.
Oh, steady on. There's children of 80s throwing things at the radios. But no, you're right. It got great reviews.
Yeah. And it was just so on point in terms of what the character was and the themes of the story. So going into Predator Badlands, I was really, really looking forward to this. And it's interesting. I'm a little bit on the fence
with how I feel. Okay, well, tell us what's happening then.
Yeah, so the story this time, we have, you're right, it's kind of in space, and it revolves around the Predators as more of a protagonist in this one. So we have one Predator in particular who's called Deck, and he's like the runt of his particular clan. He's the weakest, and he's looked down upon. His father doesn't really think he's worth the time, so to try and prove.
And sorry, he is played by a human corporeal actor, though, right?
Yes, Demetrius Schuster Kolo Matangi. So he's
just rolls off the tongue, really.
Yeah, he's someone I'm not super familiar with. I had a look into him, and he hasn't done anything super big. Ella Fanning, as you said, is probably the biggest name in this. But I think that's a long tradition with Predator movies, is you get someone maybe slightly unknown, stick them in a suit and pay them half as much as you would if it was a bigger star. So he plays Deck in this one, the kind of small Predator, and he kind of decides his mission. If he is viewed as the weakest, he needs to kill the strongest thing to kind of prove himself. So he goes to this planet, and the planet itself, everything on the planet tries to kill you. The plants are poisonous. The grass is razor sharp. The trees have kind of sentient vines that come down and try and strangle you. So as a concept, sticking the Predator on this kind of awful planet that everything wants to kill him, and he has to kill the biggest, meanest thing there, it actually sounds like a great premise. But in, I suppose, the execution of it is where things start to get a little bit strange. So as we mentioned, he runs into Ella Fanning, who plays a synthetic organism. This isn't a spoiler to say, because you can see this in the trailer.
Yeah.
But she is a synth from the Weyland-Yutani company. And people will recognize that name from the Alien franchise.
Yeah.
And she and the Predator kind of form this uneasy alliance, and they decide to help each other to track down this great big creature that he's after. But you get the sense that maybe she has ulterior motives for helping him out. And it's an interesting dynamic. Where it gets strange is then we introduce it's like a monkey kind of creature that lives on the planet. And it kind of decides to follow them around, kind of like a pet, kind of like a person. It kind of treats it's like the sidekick, and right. It follows the Predator around and copies him, and it is a bit of comic relief. Now, it's interesting because I'm too young to remember Star Wars before the Ewoks.
Yeah.
So whenever I heard people talk about them, it never clicked because they were always part of it. I think I get it now. I think I understand what people said when they introduced the Ewoks to Star Wars, that it was a bit too silly and it pushed it too far. I got that sense watching this where it was funny, but when you think of the Predator, who is one of the most iconic movie monsters of, you know, film history, and now he's in this kind of buddy adventure with the comic sidekick. It's, you know, you couldn't imagine, you know, Freddy Krueger or Jason Voorhees. It's just so bizarre. But they go, this kind of band of misfits, they go, and I suppose while they're on the planet, without giving the whole thing away, they maybe realize in search of this creature, because of all the Weyland-Yutani influence on the planet, maybe this creature, while it's ferocious, is not as dangerous as the intelligent element on the planet, this kind of corporate entity. So we kind of maybe shift our goals as we go along. So, yeah, as I say, it's an interesting one with a lot of stuff going on, and taking it at face value, it's not bad. Like, it's executed well, but viewing it through the context of a Predator movie, I think is where I get a little bit stuck.
Yeah, well, it sounds very interesting. I mean, this idea of a planet where literally, you know, the weeds will kill you, and then they, in essence, go on a road trip of sorts. I know they're not driving cars or whatever. And then this blue monkey thing, though, seems to be just far too incongruous. It's like, I think your Ewok analogy is a point well made. That seems to have maybe stretched the credulity of it for you.
Yeah, it's interesting to note this one. This film is PG-13 in America. Here it's 15s, but in America it's PG-13. It's only the second movie in the Predator franchise to be PG-13. The other one was in 2004, Alien versus Predator, which critically is, I would feel, not the type of film you want to emulate.
Yeah.
But yeah, I got the sense that this was far more watered down compared to, say, Prey or any of the other elements in the franchise. You know, so on this planet, everything is either an alien, and if the Predator is having a fight with it and he cuts into it, it's kind of got green blood or purple blood, or if he's fighting these kind of synth characters, people remember from seeing them in Alien, they're kind of like milky inside. So it's a very bloodless affair for a Predator movie. And I definitely felt that as I was watching it. I kind of, you know, not that I'm kind of blood-crazed maniac, but when you go to see a Predator movie, there's an expectation that it's going to have a certain kind of bite to it. And this felt very tame.
Right. And you think that's with an eye to getting more people into the cinema and younger people?
I would imagine so. I did get the sense of this kind of maybe studio interference, which always tends to happen, where you have a film that kind of goes under the radar, like Prey, and becomes unexpectedly so critically and financially successful that the next installment, all the eyes are on it. Everyone, all the executives are, you know, ticking the boxes to make sure. And that's when you get muddled, because even though the premise, as I said, lends itself to maybe a tamer experience, I even noticed there was one particular instance where there was one of the characters picks up this Predator, is one of his gadgets, and it's a bomb and it's going to explode. But the way it was edited, we had the ticking, the beep, 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 it's about to explode. And then we cut, and then it was the reaction. And it was like we missed the actual explosion. So it actually seemed like we, you know, a bit had been chopped out, maybe in the post-production process, which can happen sometimes if they film something that's a bit too risky, and then they decide, no, that's not going to fly with the younger audiences. Yeah. So it definitely seems like some changes have been made.
The Hollywood elves have been at play. Okay, we better take a quick clip to give listeners a sense of Predator Badlands, which is in cinemas from November 7th.
The ways of your kind the ones of violence. Either you are hunted, or you become the hunter.
Welcome to the most dangerous planet in the universe, where everything is trying to kill you. Many of your kind have come here. None have survived. You're after a creature that can't be killed.
A clip there from Predator Badlands. So, Ken, to summarize what you said again, I mean, it's an interesting movie, but really doesn't possibly belong in the Predator series, or is very different to what's gone before. Now, you could salute Dan Trachtenberg for trying something new, I guess, but ultimately, it's just too much of a stretch for you.
I think so. I that's a good point you make, that it is something different, because the other film that he made, Prey, is essentially a rehash of the original Predator, just maybe done, I don't want to say slightly better, but it's done slightly differently enough that it became its own thing. So this is different again. So I can't really fault him for not just rehashing what he's already done. But as you say, something about the execution of it, maybe it was taken out of his hand slightly, but I think it's just, it just didn't quite do it for me.
Yeah. So what are you going to say stars wise?
I'd give it 2 stars. Two out of five,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, low enough. But listen, that's why we pay him the big bucks. That's Ken Doran giving Predator Badlands, which is in cinemas this Friday, the 7th of November, 2 stars. And I'm assuming that's on everywhere. The curse of the Ewoks, it would seem, strikes again. Ken, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Ken Doran there talking to me about Predator Badlands, which is now in cinemas. Up next, Lynn Ramsey on her new film, Die, My Love. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. Now, opening in select cinemas this weekend on the 7th of November is Die, My Love, the new film from acclaimed Scottish filmmaker Lynn Ramsey. In Die, My Love, we see a visceral and uncompromising portrait of a woman engulfed by love and possibly madness. It's anchored by a ferocious performance from Jennifer Lawrence and co-stars Robert Pattinson. The film follows Grace, played by Lawrence, and her partner Jackson, played by Pattinson, who have recently moved into an old house deep in the country. With ambitions to write the great American novel, Grace settles into her new environment and the couple soon welcome a baby. However, Jackson frequently and suspiciously absent, and the pressure of domestic life starting to weigh on her, Grace begins to unravel, leaving a path of destruction in her wake, and she really unravels, and some of it is nearly hard to watch how she unravels, I have to say. And there are, I suppose, elements of postnatal depression in this story as well, which are getting some of the headlines of this movie, but it's certainly not all about that. It's a study of a couple falling apart. Based on Ariane Horowitz's celebrated novel, it also co-stars Sissy Spacek and the great Nick Nolte. I should mention as well, Seamus McGarvey is the cinematographer, and Enda Walsh co-wrote the screenplay. Now, Lynn Ramsey is a unique voice in cinema. We saw her first movie years ago, Ratcatcher, which is absolutely terrific debut movie. She's also done We Need to Talk About Kevin, You Were Never Really Here. This is her first movie in about 8 years. A unique voice in cinema. She's had a few struggles along the way with projects that never came to fruition, projects she was in essence moved off from. A very interesting filmmaker. So I spoke to Lynn Ramsey earlier in the week about Die, My Love, and a bit more besides. So listen, I was going to talk to you about postnatal depression and things like that. And then I read this morning how you kind of said people focusing on that on this movie is bullshit. This is more about love breaking down, which is probably a better thing to talk about anyway. But is that right, or have you been misreported from the streets of Cannes?
I've probably been misreported from the streets of Cannes, or I was really tired and said something. I might have said something like that. I don't know. You know, like people latch onto things a lot, you know. What I'm trying to say really is, like, it's hopefully it's more than, you know, I'm hoping that the film's about a lot of things. I'm hoping that the film, that's an aspect of the film, and it's also an aspect of the original material, but it's also about this pretty, this woman unraveling, who is, and it's also about marriage unraveling, and it's also about, a man who doesn't know how to handle this woman. It's about sex breaking down, and it's about creativity breaking down. So it's like, if you just put it in one box, I always find that a bit, just a bit easy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Tell me this, Jennifer Lawrence is terrific in it. Did it take any kind of persuading in terms of, like, I'm wondering, did you have to say to her, it's, as Leonard Cohen might say, things are going to get dark. Like, you're going to be on the ground barking at a dog like a dog. I'm not trying to be lighthearted or anything, but she goes to dark places in this. Was she on board with that from the get-go?
I think she was. I think she, when she knew it was me, you know what I mean?
Goes with the territory.
But I think, I mean, I've had quite a lot of discussions right through, and I would, I did a lot of visuals and some sound of music, and so, and we try things out. I like try, I can be really, really contr like some films. I'm so like, this is exactly how it's going to be, and we're not changing it. And in this, it was a, it was like I was reacting a bit to, that. I mean, that dog was really annoying. So, so I was like, okay, let's try this. Like, who's up for it? Like, and then some things she would just instinctively try herself. And so there was a, it was quite free in a lot of places because we had this really cool house to play in, which was a bit like a character itself. And I wanted the characters to really move through the house during the big argument and stuff like that, and just have this fluidity throughout, So each film's a different kind of vibe, but and then some pieces of the film are different, but yeah, like I think, I'd try things out. I would try things out, that was for sure. I'd try things out,
I was watching this with my wife and she said, "That's Nick Nolte." And I said, "No, it isn't." And then she said, "That's Sissy Spacek." I was like, "Are you sure?" Like, Robert Pattinson and Jennifer Lawrence are huge stars and have been in, blockbusters. I don't need to tell you. But Nick Nolte and Sissy Spacek, I don't know. It's like, oh my God, they're in the movie as well. With I don't want to say small parts, but they're not the leads. I suppose, again, a similar question. Did you always have them in mind or was it a happy casting accident? I guess you don't cast those people by accident, though.
No, I think, for the father, like, there's a few people in mind, and then I went to meet Nick in Malibu, actually. Went, yeah, and I don't know, he's got such a screen presence and stuff like that without even saying, saying anything. He says a lot, so it, and then in the case of Sissy, when I got that idea, I was like, oh my God, that would be amazing, but never ever thought I'd get her,
And you did.
And then she, like we've lots, Sissy and I spoke a lot. She really wanted to dig deep into it. And the character of the mother-in-law is quite different from the source material as well. She brought something to it, because she's a really empathetic, she wants to understand, she's earnest, and I think that made it more about her seeing that Grace more than Jackson seeing Grace,
It's funny. I thought of two other films a lot. I thought of kind of John Cassavetes and Gina Rollins, and I also thought about The Shining once or twice. Did those
Well, I'm
thoughts
so
ever occur to
happy.
you?
I'm so happy you mentioned those two.
Oh, good, good. But were they in your thinking, or did you go afterwards? Wow, there's
Well,
similarities here.
it was interesting because the book isn't a kind of completely what, women under the influence, but it has elements of it, but in a sort of more intense way. I don't know, like in terms of, but yeah, I mean, like if you. In terms of films that came up, definitely Women Under the Influence, I thought of, and The Shining in terms of the house,
And the house having its own personality, maybe, or something like that. But let's not give any kind of spoiler. Tell me this, to have one Irish man on a movie must be great, but to have two, is more than anyone could have hoped for. I'm just wondering, Seamus Egarvey, what does he give you as a cinematographer?
I think he always says you're the other DP, which is a really sweet thing for a guy, for we've known each other for years, we're really good pals. Like he lives down the road from me, and I think the good thing about working with each other, like, and we've worked on one more worked in, we talk about Kevin, that was last time, you
Mm.
know, is that I feel like he knows I understand visuals, so like it's a freedom maybe he doesn't always get, you know. We were together like in that house, you know, and it was like, you know, we're talking about aspect ratio, which is like the frame of the film,
Sure.
and we both were going CinemaScope because we shot Kevin in CinemaScope, and it's always lovely to shoot in scope.
Yeah.
But then I was like, maybe we should do it. Look at the shape of the house. Like, we're not going to see the edges of the door, and then it's like Academy, and then it's like, oh, should we shoot Day for Night? Or I was like, I really love the way the Morven Callan was shot at the end. That was Alvin Kukler, a different DP. And he's like, why don't we shoot Rehearsal? So we're like kind of kids in a sweet shop, and I think in a way that maybe he doesn't always get the chance to be it, but always
Yeah.
thinking about the characters and always thinking about the mise en scène and always thinking about you know, what are the reasons we're doing this? Like, we shot Day for Night, which is like why the night looks all like a kind of that you're in a
Yeah.
fairy tale, you know.
Yeah.
So you know, I think, I mean, I saw him last night actually. He was at the screening, and you know, and I think he's so, you know, I don't know, bowled over by the movie, like in a genuine way, you know what I mean? Like, you know,
Yeah.
his work in it is, I just think it's extraordinary, you
It
know.
is. It is. Tell me this, you know, your career. Any biog of you, it always references, you know, and we won't get into any of them, you'll be pleased to hear, but I suppose things that took a long time, things that were meant to happen and didn't happen, and you know the well-worn path of some of these conversations. But I'm wondering, big picture, is there an overarching lesson for people listening in film school or whatever, from all your experiences at this stage of career about the film business? Is it that it's very uncertain?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think because I'm maybe the projects that I'm doing are quite provocative as well, you know. It's like, you know, it's just a bit of a kind of like one of those things where you think you're doing one thing one day, and then you're doing a different thing the next day. And that's why I started writing songs and doing different things, and now I'm thinking about writing a book, you know. And so yeah, it can be, it's not a stable place, you know. But also I know I have the options in terms of, like, you know, if I want to go do something, you know, that's not as, you know, like this, like a low budget thing or whatever, I could probably do that, you know. So, but I suppose I challenge myself always as a filmmaker, and they're quite tough projects, you know, but it can be a difficult ride, you know.
Yeah, indeed it can. My favorite movie of yours is the first one I saw, and your first one, Ratcatcher. I'm just wondering, when you look back on that now, given where you are now, was it very guerrilla filmmaking? Seat of the pants, no one's really paying that much attention. Like, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but was there a huge freedom making that as well as possible terror?
It was terrifying making Ratcatcher, but you know, I think it was my least favorite film to make in a
Okay.
way, because I just only made like 15 minutes, almost silent short.
Yeah.
And it was all a lot of film students as well. I went up to Glasgow, and I really fought for all my heads of department and stuff like that, because you know, when people are going to give you money, they want to know they've got the well-worn DP and the well.
Yeah.
But I'm glad I did, you know. But I loved making it in terms of the cast. That's what really kept me going. It was the kids and stuff like that. And there was a real beauty and innocence in it that I think is there in the film. But it's an experience. It was terrifying. You know, the first day, you know, first features are really, oh my God, you know. So, you know,
Yeah.
I've got to be honest, you know.
Well, it all worked out more or less. So lovely to talk to you and continued success. And I hope the new one travels far and wide for you. Nice to talk to you.
You too, John. Thank you so much.
So, do you think you'll have another one?
Yeah, pregnant now.
Picking up twins.
What happened to your hands?
Oh, you should see the wall.
Yeah, I am. I have two kids, and two is a lot, if I'm being honest.
Seems like it.
Babies, though. Babies are hard. I don't think anybody talks about that enough.
It's all anyone talks about.
It changes you. I think I nearly lost my mind for the first 6 months.
When do you think you'll be getting it back?
You know, postnatal depression is so much more common than people think.
think I'm gonna give it a shot with music though.
What do you do for work, Craze?
I don't. I'm stuck between wanting to do something and not wanting to do anything at all.
A clip there from Die My Love with Jennifer Lawrence and Robert Pattinson. And you heard me talking to its director, Lynn Ramsey there, the great Scottish director. And Die My Love is in cinemas as we speak from this Friday, the 7th of November. Up next, one of the world's most famous photographers, Missam Harriman, chats to me about being the subject of a new documentary called Shoot the People. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talks TV and movie show. Missam Harriman is a Nigerian-born British photographer and social activist, as well as being one of the most widely shared photographers of the Black Lives Matter movement. He's the first black man to shoot a cover of British Vogue in its 104-year history back in July 2021. He's photographed modern icons such as Meghan Markle, Prince Harry, Rihanna, Stormzy, Kate Blanchett, Tom Cruise, and Spike Lee. Missam is a self-taught photographer. And as we learn in a new documentary called Shoot the People, Missam had a whole other life in the world of recruitment before he became a working photographer. Shoot the People, which has been shown on Friday the 14th of November as part of the 70th anniversary edition of the Cork International Film Festival, follows Missam Harriman around as he documents contemporary protest movements, investigating why so many people feed the need to physically come together and demand better than those in charge. We also hear about his life and journey and see him attend the Oscars for his short film The After, which was nominated for Best Short in 2024. I should mention, Shoot the People is directed by BAFTA winner Andy Mundy Castle, and I'm delighted to say that Missam Harriman joins me now. Missam, hi, how are you?
Hey, I'm great. How are you?
I'm very well. Sorry about that long intro, but you're befitting one, I think.
That's very kind. Thank you very much.
Not at all. So what I was surprised about, I'd seen some of your photographs online, as so many people, millions of people around the world have. But the idea of you coming to this, I don't want to say late in life, but as I mentioned, you had another career. You were in recruitment in London, almost, you know, one of those, the documentary presents it as almost like a cliched London existence where you're heading to Ibiza and, you know, living a Rylan middle class life, if I may be so bold. I'm wondering, what was the moment when you thought, you know what, maybe I should try and take pictures for a living? Or did it not happen like that?
The social programming of our lives means that I think we are raised to aspire to certain things. The accumulation of wealth and patriarchy means as well that I think men in particular are told they have to be certain things. And it took me, four decades to really get on the path that I'm always supposed to be on. I enjoyed working in the city. I enjoyed working in recruitment, but there was always my inner child whispering to me, saying that maybe there was another way that I could go. And thank God, my wife allowed me to take the road less traveled.
Well, God bless her for that. And I'm awfully glad she did. You know, I'm sure people talk to you about this all the time, but the photo that's of the many photos we see in the documentary that's most arresting is the one you take at a London Black Lives Matter protest with a girl holding a sign saying, "Why is ending racism a debate?" I mean, is that the kind of, is, you know, if you were looking back on your life as you've lived it up until now, is that the moment that things changed radically for you in every sense of that phrase?
Yeah, I mean, I think that photo changed my life. I don't think I would have got the Vogue cover if I didn't, you know, it was seen by Martin Luther King's son and shared to millions of people. And then every celebrity under the moon saw the image. So it is a defining image. It's one of the most shared images of the digital age as well. And it asks the central question, which sadly we still have to ask today. So if there was one image that has changed everything that's happened to me really in the last 5 years, it would be that one. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, you mentioned Martin Luther King's son, and you have a very, it is emotional. I found an emotional meeting with him, and he talks about his father's legacy. You take a photograph of him. He talks to you about your picture. I presume, given your background, but I mean, even aside from that, just, you know, being a human being who grew up in the 20th century, that must have been a very emotive moment to sit down with him.
That day, honestly, I just held back tears the whole day. I mean, he's the only living son of Martin Luther King now, MLK 3. Yeah. And, you know, we're in Atlanta, which is the birthplace of Martin Luther King himself. And I'm just there nervous. And when he arrived, he just had this safeness to him, this warmth, and I felt like his father was in the room. It's a strange thing to say, and for him to even know that I exist or even care about my work, I mean, honestly, you know, you think about these moments, and then you suddenly, I'm sitting opposite him, and he's telling me that my work's important. It's like, what it's even now. And my kids, you know, I have two little girls. They think I'm completely uninteresting. One day, you know, they may see that clip and say, okay, Dad, you did all right.
Yeah, well, that's lovely. That's lovely. I have three kids who think the work I do is very uninteresting as well. I think that's the way it's meant to be.
It's a rite of passage.
Yeah. Bruce Springsteen said, your kids are not meant to be your fans. So take comfort in that. Tell me this, and the more serious side of things, you know, when it comes to protests, and we see you at many of them throughout the film, it's, you know, to my mind, I've rethought about protests having watched the documentary, because protests, in a way, you know, to me, almost seem like a vestige of the past, how we used to do things, whether it was like communist Russia, you know, when they got rid of the czars, or even in Ireland, where we've had lots of protests, particularly in the north of the country, or women getting on trains, going to Belfast to get condoms. It seems almost like protests were a thing that we used to do. But what the film really, you know, infuses people with the idea is that maybe the only way things ever change is by protests. Could you say a little something about that?
Yeah, I think especially in modern man, protest movements have shaped us in ways that we don't always recognize, but from the suffragettes and even beyond the suffragettes, before the suffragettes, it's always happened. And we are living through a time of protest in a way that I don't think I've seen in my adult life, whether it is, you know, I work a lot with the queer community, the trans community, climate activists, women's rights, obviously anti-racism, Palestine. But what's really interesting is that there is an intersectionality of it that people have only realized recently, seeing that it's actually the same patriarchal, hyper-extractive capitalist machine that is allowing, you know, boys to be crushed in mines so we can have faster phones, that is allowing the garment industry to take advantage of those that do not have any voice or agency, that is allowing bombs to be dropped on tents in Palestine, and people connecting the dots and saying, maybe, just maybe, we can have a better world that is a little bit gentler and a little bit kinder. And that, one of the central pillars of that, is literal people walking the streets saying, we will not accept this. If our leaders, if our press and our politicians are apathetic, we will show that we will build community through empathy. And I think, hopefully, the film shows that quite well.
Yeah. And so, is protest more important than ever?
Protest is the culture. It is, you know, we live in the time of resistance. We cannot have a time now where there is a man that is worth $450 billion that can literally rent Venice for his wedding when when a huge chunk of the children of the world are living in abject poverty and there are multiple genocides being prosecuted around the world. We will not accept that. And the way we will change that is to build community through organizing. And that protest is one of the central pillars of that, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, Paul should know a thing or two about protest and resisting and rebelling.
Indeed. The rebels, as they're often referred to, Corkonians. Tell me this. One of the very interesting moments in it is, I suppose, a real dichotomy or juxtaposition. I mentioned you're nominated for The After, which is a brilliant watch. I remember watching it last year, actually thinking it was going to win. But you're going to the Oscars and you look sharp in this lovely green jacket. You're making jokes with your pals about going kind of full Nigerian in the speech that made me laugh a lot since you went to see Star Wars. And yet you're passing a protest about Palestine on the way, and you talk about wanting to jump out of the car, but yet you don't, right? And I'm not saying you should have, but, you know, the devil's advocate in me said, well, you passed that protest and you went to the Oscars. And it's a great moment in the doc because you seem conflicted by that.
I mean, I was. Look, I was nominated for an Oscar. It's a huge moment. But the reality is, if I was a guest at the Academy Awards, I would have jumped out of that car, probably been arrested. Yeah. But I thought, you know, I knew it was between Wes Anderson and me for the Oscar. And I thought, if there's a fighting chance of me winning, which there was, I could get on that stage and do a speech for the ages to a billion people. Mm. And that's what kept me in the car, with the hope that I could use that opportunity to really make a speech.
Yeah. And would that speech have made reference to Palestine or Black Lives Matters or all of the above?
Come on now. You know me better than that. What do you think? Come on.
I think I know how it might have gone. Listen, tell me this. I mentioned your wife. You know, she must be quite, you mentioned she was understanding because she, you know, told you to go for it. But I mean, you mentioned those two lovely children you have. You're probably away a lot for your work. I guess there's accommodations have to be made in your life for the work that you do.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not easy. Our kids are young and they you know, I need them as much as they need me. But we are living through, we're on the precipice of something pretty awful. And I wonder what future my girls will inherit. And there isn't, you know, an understanding in my household that I've got to go out there to try and carve out a world that is livable for them. And my weapons of choice, you know, are my lens and my voice. And that's just where we are. There are no other options right now.
Yeah. There's probably certain questions you're asked a lot, and I fear you've probably been asked this one a lot, but I just have to get your view on it. Like, in terms of, you know, camera phones, the democratization of photography in a way that people take images all the time and share them a lot quicker than they did 20 or certainly 50 years ago. The fact that so many people have access to being photographers now, like, I'm sure the Democrat in you thinks that's great, but also, you know, you want to value the guy or the girl who goes out with a good piece of equipment and spends hours looking for that shot. Like, where do you stand on that?
I mean, anyone with a camera and or phone should bear witness, and if you have the ability to truly bear witness, it will always cut through. You know, my exhibition is on in London at the moment, and it's by far the busiest gallery show in the West End. Hundreds of people are flying over from, you know, Cambodia and Australia, because the images, you feel them more than even seeing them.
Yeah.
So if you want to be a poet of light, recognize that there is something inherently important between the highlights and the shadows of an image. And if you don't recognize that, they'll just be forgettable, you know, algorithmic shite that people will just scroll on and get on with their lives. But if you Robert Frank, the great photographer, said the eye should learn to listen before it looks. If you understand what compositionally you're doing and you're finding truth in the human condition, then you can do something extraordinary. And I think maybe that's why people feel my images speak to them.
Yeah, that's brilliantly said. Shoot the People, as I mentioned, is going to be in Cork on Friday the 14th of November as part of the Cork International Film Festival. The director, as well as the subject, that's Andy Mundy Castle, will be doing a Q&A afterwards along with Missam Harriman. And I gather Rosie O'Donnell is going to be hosting that QOA, an Irish resident. So you must be looking forward to that, Missam.
Yeah, I mean, Rosie O'Donnell, again, we've become fast friends because of our activism, and she is an earth angel, you know, a generational voice for the voiceless. Deeply proud to know her and can't wait to see her in Ireland.
Yeah. And listen, people often ask you about Prince Harry and Meghan Markle and Tom Cruise. I've not as much interest in them as I do in Spike Lee, because I just adore that man's films. I'm wondering what he was like to shoot.
I mean, you know, I think he changed my life in many ways. Do the Right Thing, Jungle Fever. I saw them at very specific times in my life. Malcolm X. So it was like meeting a deity, you know. I don't usually get nervous, but I was. But he had the grace to allow me to bear witness. I think he uses my portrait of him on quite a lot of press, which makes me very proud. So he's clearly happy. And he is one of the greatest ones to ever do it. I'm deeply proud of being able to have taken his portrait.
Well, listen, aside from being a fantastic photographer, you are a deeply articulate man, and it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. My guest has been Missam Herriman, whose film, well, he's the subject of it, Shoot the People, will be on at Cork International Film Festival on the 14th of November. Missam, it was lovely to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Missam Herriman there, talking to me about the documentary he is the subject of, Shoot the People. Fascinating watch and a fascinating guy, as you heard there. He is going to be in Cork for the screening of that, with a conversation with him and the director, Andy Mundycastle, questioned by the great Rosie O'Donnell in the Q&A. It's on the 14th of November as part of the Cork International Film Festival that runs from the 6th of November, so it's already started, to the 16th. And you can find out, of course, more details on their website, Cork International Film Festival. That is it for this week. Thank you for listening. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Get in touch with me at any stage about anything you've been watching. You can email us screentime@newstalk.com. Just a little time to squeeze in some music from the movies. Last week, we raved about the Martin Scorsese documentary, which is on Apple TV, and it's brilliant. So do check it out if you haven't already. And I was reminded of some of the great music used in his movies. And I'd forgotten about this gem from The Color of Money, which he directed, which is a follow-up to The Hustler. I'm going to leave you with the great Werewolves of London by Warren Zevon, and wish you a happy remainder to your weekend.
I saw a werewolf with a Chinese menu in his hand, walking through the streets of Soho in the rain.